This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some men and women around you who have some stories to tell, and when you take the time to listen, it might change your perspective a little bit. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot in these glimpses into history from people who lived it in places like Wasco, California. That's where I am today. This year, Wasco High School is celebrating its centennial, 100 years, and two guys who went to that school we're going to hear from today. They happen to be brothers. They were growing up just a stone's throw from where we are today, where they both live on some acreage of pistachio trees and a whole lot of impressive brickwork around here. And the hands that laid those bricks belong to Emery Crawford, 90 years old. You're a Wasco lifer, huh? How old were you when you moved to this town?
I was 5 years old when we moved to Wasco from Long Beach.
And you've been here ever since, except for Uncle Sam's little detour, huh?
Yes, that's right. I've always been farming here all my life. I guess I'm going to stay here.
I guess so, and it's going to be a while because obviously you're still as active as just about anybody. You just showed me a video of you and your little brother David parasailing at Lake Tahoe just a few months ago. So I know you're a thrill seeker, and one of the thrills you two had was going on an honor flight to Washington, D.C. I want to talk about that too. But take me way, way back to when you first moved here to Wasco, California, a little northwest of Bakersfield in California's San Joaquin Valley. What was it like here during the Great Depression out in a farm community like Wasco?
When my father lived in Long Beach and he worked in the oil fields, and he had a sister that lived here in Wasco, so he had a chance to farm at 20 acres. And they farmed it with a team of mules. There wasn't any tractors in. I was a very bashful boy. I wasn't very good around company. I knew my family, and I associated with them, but outside of that, I didn't. And so when I started school, I had problems, and I grew up all the way through grade school, through high school, and I was in the FFA, which really helped me get to know people and associate with people. And I admired those people that could get up in front of people and talk and everything. But since I went to Honor Flight, my life has completely changed. And I talk all the time now to different people. And it's been a great thing for me.
And that never happened until Honor Flight?
That's correct.
Well, that's a ringing endorsement, and regular listeners have heard me talk a lot about Honor Flight. It's an effort going on all over the country to take our World War II veterans to Washington, D.C. to see their memorial, and you were on one of the very first flights, I think the second flight ever from Kern County, Honor Flight Kern County. They're still taking people from this area to Washington, D.C., and you got to take your little brother with you. What was that like to share that experience with him?
Well, it was, I guess, one of the great experiences of my life is to go on back to Washington and visit and see the memorials and the cemetery and going into the Capitol. They were people just come right up to you and shake your hand and thank you. And I got more hugs from women then than anywhere.
You know, all those guys who we haven't been able to convince to take this flight, now they're ready to go after you said that line about all the hugs.
Yeah, it was a great experience. And David, he's kind of into aviation, and he liked to go to the aviation museum, and he got to see the Enola Gay, and that was a good experience for him, I know.
And a lot of people go on an honor flight, and they have a great experience, and they share it with a guardian, whether that's a family member or not, and they have the chance to get to those memorials and remember the guys they knew who didn't come home from the war. But not everybody stays involved the way you have. Now, every time Honor Flight Kern County makes a trip, you're there to send them off and greet them when they come home?
We make it a habit to try to go to all of the Honor Flight when they leave and when they come in to give them a send-off and welcome them home, because I know what an experience it was for me.
Well, and this honor flight, all those flights are commercial flights, so a lot of those takeoffs are early in the morning, and they get home late at night. You're out there at 10 o'clock at night waiting for these guys?
Yeah, sometimes it was almost 12 o'clock when they got in. But we want to be out there to welcome them in.
Why do you do that? What do you get out of it?
Well, I enjoy it, and I guess it's a good experience for me as well as for them. And I want them to enjoy the time when they come home and see all of the people that are there to welcome them, and it's an excitement to me.
Well, and if I'm going to ask Big Brother, I guess I got to ask younger brother. David Crawford's 88 years old. He's back in Wasco after more than six decades in Oklahoma, but you shared that honor flight with your brother, and you heard what he was just saying about it. What have you gotten out of this connection to honor flight? It seems like it gives you guys a lot of energy here.
Well, it gives us a chance to go talk to other vets, and we really enjoy talking, at least I do. Or that was a great experience going out to Washington for me. Arlington was kind of emotional. And a lady friend there at Walmart, she wanted me to have my picture taken there on Lincoln's lap. But I'm afraid I couldn't get up that high.
Yeah, that would take some climbing at the Lincoln Memorial. You just heard your brother say the change that the Honor Flight experience produced in him. Have you seen that? Does he seem like a different guy to you?
Well, yes, he's more talkative now. And we enjoy going there early and being able to talk with all the other vets there.
What do you remember about your childhood out here on the farm?
I remember the old reservoir I used to go swimming with over at my uncle's place.
Did your brother beat you up?
He never did. He wasn't big enough then.
You're what, about a year and a half younger?
A year and 10 months.
So did you always kind of look up to him, follow after him a little bit, or not so much?
We always stayed pretty close together. Fact is, where we're at now at these places, the women say, you watch out for them two old men.
Yeah, now that you guys are kind of roommates here, it's like being in college again or something, huh?
Yeah, we try to think of places to go now. We got time. We're going to go to just about anything we can find that we want to go to.
Watch out, world. The Crawford boys are coming. So, Emery, let me come back to you. I asked you about the depression, and one of the reasons I like to ask veterans about that is so many of them said that that was a really valuable experience to live through that time, and so many of us alive today really don't know what it was like. Was it hard during the depression around these parts?
It was very hard. There was a grove of trees down about an eighth of a mile where we live. And they were migrant workers from Oklahoma, moved into those trees, put up tents, and lived there. No electricity, no water, no toilets. They just tried to get work. There wasn't enough work to keep them all busy. And we lived on 20 acres, and we had lots of chickens. So we had chickens to eat, and we raised some hogs and had hogs. I always ran a big garden. My mother would spend the summer canning fruit and vegetables. We had two cows, and me and David done the milking. We didn't have a refrigerator to start with. She put the milk out on the table, and she'd let the creams rise to the top, and she'd skim it off. And then it was me and David's job to, with a crock churn to start with, to churn that cream. She had a butter mold, and she would mold it. And she had eggs and milk to sell, and she had a route that customers that she could deliver them to. To start with, she didn't have a washing machine. She done the laundry in a tub with the rub board, and then she hung clothes up on the line. And you know, one night with the clothes out there, somebody come and got all those clothes off the clothesline, and that was a big loss to us at that time. But because we had the chickens and the garden and all, we got by real well considering, but those people that migrated from Oklahoma and the other areas because of the Dust Bowl, they really had a hard time. And I can see a lot of them nowadays. They really turned out good.
The other kind of unforgettable historical event that just about everyone I've talked to has a memory of, if they were alive then, and certainly you were in high school, December 7th, 1941. Do you remember how you found out about Pearl Harbor?
You know, I don't remember. David, he says he remembers, but I don't remember. I was probably in school.
Well, let me ask David if he says he remembers. What do you remember? You were a little younger, so you were probably, I guess you were a freshman in high school probably, huh? What do you remember about that day?
Well, they called us all into assembly and was telling us all about the Japanese, how they bombed Pearl Harbor there. Of course, at the time, all I seen was that little tiny island over there of Japan. I thought, well, that won't be no problem. But they really tore us up there at Pearl Harbor, though.
So you were at Wasco High School, and they brought everyone into the gym or something to tell them about it?
Big auditorium there in Wasco here.
Did it hit you that at some point you might have to end up in the military?
Well, yes. I'd looking forward to it, but my mother wasn't.
Especially after your brother went in, I bet. Your mother really probably held on to you then.
I'll tell you, she really worried about Emory.
Well, before I ask him about that, what do you remember of that? So often we hear about the veterans' experience, but not the family back home. So you remember when your brother went into the service and how that made things at home?
Yeah, I didn't have him around to fuss at anymore.
Was that a good thing or a bad thing?
No, that was a bad thing. I missed him a lot.
Were you worried about him? Did you think, I don't know if I'm going to see him again?
Well, I thought he'd be able to take care of himself. I guess I was too young to do much worrying back then.
Would you say he was one of the tougher kids around Wasco? How did he fit in back then?
Well, back then, he was too bashful. fact is, when he went to kindergarten, when they called him inside the room to sit around there and listen to, he'd go out there and hide. He wouldn't even come inside.
Well, how did you, Emory, end up in the Army? You ended up serving with the 255th Infantry Regiment of the 63rd Infantry Division in Europe. But how did you end up in the Army?
I was drafted. They put me in the infantry, into the Army as an infantry, and I had my basic training in Calhoun, Texas. On the way home after my training, I come home on not a troop train, just a regular train. There wasn't any seats when I got on it. I had to sit on my duffel bag, and the train was 36 hours late getting into Wasco on the schedule. And I didn't have a seat all the way home. And that was an experience, too. When I started to go overseas, I got on a troop train and went to the East Coast to spend Christmas there. There was families that would take in veterans and furnish them with a dinner, and I went out with a couple, had a nice dinner. I didn't drink any kind of alcoholic drink or smoke, but they had a nice meal, and they had wine, and it embarrassed me that I wouldn't drink wine with them. I got on a merchant ship that was converted to a troop ship, I think about a three-week trip, going over to Le Havre, France. I was in a convoy. We got into a storm that rocked the boat way over almost 45 degrees. Water was coming over the deck, and they locked us below deck for 3 days. The head got plugged up. Stuff was going across the floor. Soldiers were getting sick, but, you know, I never got sick, but boy, it was a mess.
I guess so. When you say stuff was going across the floor, you mean some real dirty, foul, smelly stuff going across the floor.
Yes, stuff from the bathroom. Yeah, it was a mess. And we tried to eat first during that storm by standing up at the counter or with our plates. You take your hand off the plate, it was gone. And broke. We broke, I don't know how many plates during that time. So they stopped feeding us with plates and giving us box lunches and things instead. That was an experience just on the boat going over to Le Havre, France.
Yeah, were you a little scared there, wondering if you're ever going to go fight the enemy, if you're going to survive this trip across the Atlantic?
Well, I wondered about it, but, you know, when you're 18, 19 years old, you don't think about death. You don't think anything's ever going to happen to you. And I guess I kind of felt that way, that never thought about being killed. But I think that may be in the minds of most young people when they go into service. But when you get on the front line and you face the enemy, things change.
And we'll hear about how that changed for Emory Crawford when we come back. Hop on to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos of Emory and his brother David, even video from just a couple months back of these two World War II veterans parasailing at Lake Tahoe. Can you believe that? Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Close to 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Two for the price of one today. Two brothers from Wasco, California, who both served in World War II and who are pretty inseparable all these years later. We'll hear more from younger brother David Crawford before we're done. But for now, big brother Emory explains his first taste of combat with the 63rd Infantry Division, 255th Regiment, in February of 1945.
There was a railroad track, and the company was on a defensive position behind the railroad track, and that's where I went to. And the snow was on the ground, and it began to melt, and dead horses were being exposed and dead bodies. I come down with a case of diarrhea for 3 days. I couldn't do a thing. So it's a good thing we were on a defensive position, because I couldn't have done anything.
And you were a replacement troop, and just that name in itself is kind of intimidating. That means the guy who was there got killed or hurt, so they needed you. But did that hit you at the time, that this is going to be pretty dangerous?
Well, you know, really, I didn't think about that, but I knew I was a replacement, but I didn't think about being killed. We sit there on the defensive position for quite a while. And then they said, we're going to take the woods. And when we started across, when the infantry, the riflemen, were out front and started across the woods, the meadow, and the Germans were in the trees on the other side, they opened up with machine gun fire, cross machine gun fire. They dropped in mortar rounds and 88s. They pinned down all of those riflemen out in the middle of that meadow all day long, and it was night before they could get out. And during that time, there was a good portion of our company was either killed or injured. And I heard that it was 80% of the company was lost that way.
And where were you while that was going on?
Well, I was in a mortar squad and in a weapons platoon, and I hadn't got out in the meadow, so I was back in the woods on the other side, and so I wasn't exposed to all that gunfire and mortar fire.
Were you guys firing your mortars, or were you in a spot where you just had to sit there and watch?
We just had to sit there and watch.
That had to be awful.
Now, there was a little tank attached to us, and he went out into the clearing, was firing into the woods. 88s dropped right in on them. They must have had the place zeroed down, because they just wiped that tank out in no time at all. And right then, I was glad I wasn't in the tank division, because when you get hit by a cannon, you don't have a chance. I guess later on, the next day, and so they reorganized, and we got into the woods, and that's when we had almost hand-to-hand fighting with the Germans, but I was in the weapons tune behind, so I wasn't a rifleman right out there in the front. Those were the heroes that had to face all that. So I felt glad that I wasn't right out there in the front. Maybe that's a bad feeling.
Well, the bad feeling is when you know some of those guys who are getting killed, and when you realize that, as you said, an 80% casualty rate, that's catastrophic. How did you deal with that at the time, with this awareness that guys are dropping all around you?
Well, I wasn't aware how many were being killed, but I was concerned, yeah. But being just a 19-year-old boy, you don't think about death too much then, but when something like that happens, you begin to think about it.
And in that mortar platoon, what did your duties consist of?
Well, first I was an ammo bearer to carry the rockets, and then later on I became the gunner, and I had to carry that 30-pound mortar on my shoulder. They took my rifle away from me and gave me a .45 pistol, and that .45 pistol didn't feel very safe. Then when Patton started his big push into Germany, we began to follow up behind him, and they took the mortar away from me and gave me a bazooka. So I was walking and walking and walking, following up behind Patton's push, cleaning out, checking, make sure there wasn't any straggler German people. I got come down with strep throat for 3 days. I couldn't hardly talk, but we had run all left everything, so there wasn't any place for me to go. So I just kept walking and got over it. But we would walk from, say, 5 in the morning until about 10 at night, or maybe later, dig a slit trench, one person lay down and the other guard, and every 2 hours you'd shift. And when I wake up in the morning, if I lay in there, I'd have frost all over my shoes. We had shoe packs, and they give us an extra liner to go in the shoe. We carried one underneath our jacket pinned to it to dry it out, and then change every day. And when we got caught up with Patton there at the Siegfried line, they put us up in the mountains there, and I guess all of the German defense was down in the valley there. And when we went into the Siegfried line, there was no resistance. There was no German defense there. And the next morning, here come the armor up through where we were and went in. After that, that's about all of the war I was involved in. And I was put on guard at, say, this warehouse where I found my helmet and my Luger, and I kept it as a souvenir. I was put on guard at a underground factory that went back into the mountains for about 20 miles with a railroad track through it and little tunnels off to the side where they built airplane engines. Then our unit was, they done away with it. And I was transferred to a headquarters company. They said they wanted 3 volunteers, you, you, and you. And I was one of those 3. And I was put into the PX in downtown Frankfurt, Germany. Frankfurt, Germany was practically rubble then. There wasn't hardly any buildings standing. And I was stayed there the rest of the time I was in the occupation of Germany, which was really a nice place to be. They gave me an apartment downtown. I went to work at 8 o'clock in the morning and got off at 5. We had German workers working the PX, and we just had to supervise. That was a good time over there for me. I had an opportunity to go on the Swiss Rome tour. That was a very good experience, too.
Few questions I have here. So you got over there and went into combat. It's still the winter, early 1945, right after the Battle of the Bulge. That's why they needed so many people, or part of the reason. You talked about the mortar, and you talked about the bazooka. Most people haven't operated either of those weapons. Can you give us a taste when it's time to fire, when the battle's going on? What that's like on that mortar squad, how frequently you're firing, or what that experience is like?
Well, while we were on the defensive position there behind the railroad track, we set up the mortars and we would fire over into the enemy's position a lot of times at night. And one time, boy, there was a big explosion and fire over there from one of our rockets. But when you're on the move, you don't have much use for a mortar. But on the defensive position there, we used it a lot. You just fire over our people into their position. You don't know what damage you might be doing, whether you killed anybody or anything like that. So, as far as I know, I didn't kill anybody while I was over there. Now, I could have went from the mortar.
Just reading your facial expression there, maybe that's a good thing, that you don't know whether the shells you fired killed anybody or not.
Yeah, I would hate to know whether I'd killed anybody to speak of, because I don't believe in killing.
Well, the other thing that comes to mind, if you're firing your mortar, that's one direction. But isn't there stuff coming back the other direction? And how close did it come to you?
I never experienced any 88s or anything coming into where I was. Most of it was out there on that meadow that I remember. You know, after the Battle of the Bulge, that was pretty much the end of the war as far as what Germany was going to be able to do. They were on the run back home. That conflict we had with Germany there, I don't know why we had so much resistance there with them, because right after that, there wasn't any. We just started walking.
I know the weather conditions were tough to deal with. I mean, you're sleeping out in the open if you have time to sleep. You're walking constantly. You're worried about your feet freezing. I'm sure the food wasn't all that fantastic. What was the toughest part of it to deal with? Was there an aspect of your service that was the most scary, the most agonizing, the most nerve-rattling?
Well, I think that time with the conflict with the Germans on that meadow in the trees would be the one that would stick most in my mind as one of the worst times. But that walking, you run off and left your kitchen, you're living off the land as you walk, and it was cold, boy. You would stop and rest for a few minutes, and you're ready to get up and go again because it got so cold. We would go into some of these small villages and go into their chicken house and get some eggs, go into the cellar and get some bread and jelly so that we could have something to eat. But some of those German residents would be down in the cellar huddled up, scared of us. That wasn't a very good experience, too.
You mentioned the underground factory. Do you know where that was?
No, I couldn't really tell you where it was. It was in Germany, but that's about all I can say. It was in a mountain.
Well, and the only reason I ask is because there were so many of those where they hollowed out mountains. They had these underground factories so that they couldn't be bombed under there because, you know, the enemy couldn't see where they were. But a lot of times the work in the factory was done by slave labor, people that they had captured and imprisoned and were treating horribly. And there were some concentration camps where the Jewish prisoners were sent to perform that slave labor. Were you aware of, at all of what was going on in the concentration camps? Had you heard anything about that?
No, I hadn't heard anything till later on about that. I didn't get to that area at all.
Was that kind of hard to believe when you did find out about it?
Oh, yeah, it was hard to believe, to think of trying to destroy a race of people. It's just unbelievable. But on that underground factory, there was a tunnel that went back into the mountain, and then there were little tunnels going off the side, and there were lathes in there, and they had to be people that was good at working with lathes to make these airplane engine parts. So I don't know if they'd have any slave labor in there.
Well, I did a little research, and that factory was in Wiesensteig. You can actually drive through that very same tunnel today. It was actually just a highway tunnel, the Lammerbuckel Tunnel, completed in 1942, but the Nazis enclosed both ends of that 2,000-foot-long tunnel, and as Emery indicated, it had other tunnels connecting to the main one. I've got a link to the history of that tunnel at hometownheroesradio.com. and a picture of one of the armored doors barring the entrance when the 63rd Infantry Division arrived in Wiesensteig. But back to Emery's memories. What did it mean to you when you heard that Germany had surrendered?
It was a great feeling. And after the war, I was guarding some prisoners. They gave me a rifle, but they wouldn't give me any bullets to go with it. I don't know if they was afraid the Germans taken away from them or afraid we'd kill them.
What were your interactions like with those German prisoners?
They weren't trying to do anything. They knew the war was over, and so we weren't worried about them.
Did you feel any animosity toward them, or did they seem like they could have been from Wasco or Corcoran, for all you knew?
No, I didn't have any animosity against them. But I know some of the, we had one soldier that his brother had been killed, and he had it against him, boy. But as far as I was concerned, I didn't have any ill feelings to him, because I figured they were soldiers doing the job, what they're supposed to do.
You mentioned your helmet and your Luger, some pretty unique souvenirs that you brought home with you. How did you stumble across those?
While I was guarding a storage shed, I was walking around in the shed, and on the shelf, I seen this helmet and an oily rag in it. And so I went over and picked it up and took the oily rag and unwrapped it. And there was the Luger in it. So somebody had oiled it, stored it, and hoped to come back to get it, I guess. But I took it.
So you've got a German pistol and a German helmet. And you've had them for 70 years. When you look at that helmet now, what do you think about?
Well, I wonder about the person who wore it. It had a break in the helmet. I don't know whether it's a shrapnel or something that broke it. And I was just wondering about the person who it belonged to. I don't know if I want to return it to him, to the family. I want to keep it.
Is there a party? I know I don't want to exaggerate, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but are there times where you look at something like that and you say, boy, I'm glad our side won. I wonder what things would have been like if we didn't.
Oh, yeah. If Germany and Japan had won the war, I don't know what our country would be like, because we have the best form of the government that I think the world has ever known. We have people that represent us. We don't have a ruler that has all the power to govern us, but we are people by the people and for the people, and we decide who will lead us. And we have the freedom to worship and do what we want to do. And if they had won the war, I don't know what we'd been like.
You articulated those principles very well, and it makes me wonder if, at the time, if that's what you felt you were fighting for, those principles and ideals of America.
Yes, I think so. Yeah, we were fighting for the freedom to live and live a life free from domination by anybody. But, you know, I guess I'd call it sin in the world. There are people like to dominate one another. We can't seem to get along with just like nowadays is fighting one another over there in Asia, and it's hard for me to visualize people that want to control everything like that.
Well, and we all hope that being aware of history can have some impact on the future. We shall see. In our immediate future, we'll hear more from Emery and also his brother David, two of the Wasco Union High School graduates who will be part of a centennial celebration for that school in October. A few years ago, some students there researched the young men from Wasco who had died in World War II. The population of the city then was just a shade over 4,000, but 32 of Wasco's finest paid the ultimate price. I have a link to some of that information at hometownheroesradio.com, but just for example, some of them died in the Battle of the Bulge, in the horrendous Typhoon Cobra in the Pacific, in combat, in training. So many different stories, but think about that number, 32 from a little town of 4,000 people. We're thankful to have two of Wasco's surviving World War II veterans with us on the program today, and we're back with the rest of Hometown Heroes right after this.
From the creators of Courageous and Fireproof comes War Room, a powerful new film about fighting life's battles in prayer.
This is my favorite place in this house. I call it my war room.
Because prayer is a powerful weapon. War Room, now playing. Starring Alex Kendrick, Priscilla Shirer, and Beth Moore.
We need an army of believers. Raise them up, Lord. Raise them up.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested. Tickets and showtimes available now at warroomthemovie.com. This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with a spirited pair of brothers from Wasco, California. David Crawford is 88, spent most of his adult life in Oklahoma, where he became a licensed pilot and pursued his passion for astronomy. But for the last few years, he's been back in Wasco with his older brother, Emery, who's 90 now and has been on the same farmland there since he was 5, with the exception of 2 years in the Army during World War II. Emery, how did you feel about your little brother ending up in the Army? Were you a little concerned about him?
I didn't give much thought to it at the time where I was, but naturally I wouldn't want him in the service. The war was pretty well over when he went in, so I didn't have much concerns. Now, if they hadn't dropped that bomb over in Japan to end the war, there would have been a lot of service people die trying to take Japan.
Well, and that's what I was wondering. Because you're still in Europe at the time when that bomb is dropped, but you know your brother's in the Army and training, probably to head to the Pacific.
I'm sure they were trading him for the invasion of Japan.
Right.
Yeah, that would be a big concern, yeah. There would be thousands and thousands of people killed on both sides trying to conquer Japan without that atomic bomb forcing them to surrender.
You proud of your brother?
I'm very proud of him. We've been living here, I think, going on 3 years now, isn't it? You know, where I go, he goes. Where he goes, I go almost. Very close. And we get along just fine. But we don't argue as long as he minds me.
Tell me something about your brother that you admire, you appreciate.
Well, he's a very sensitive person. He's always taken up for me when I get in trouble. One time I had a fight. I don't know how I got involved in the fight. He says I had one. And I got a bloody nose, and I stopped, and he jumped in and took over where I left off. And then I got through, I could jump back in.
And that was just last month.
Not hardly. No, that was back in the lower grades, not even high school. Like he said, I was a bashful person. And he said something about in kindergarten, Miss Howard was my kindergarten teacher. I never said one word the whole 9 months I was in kindergarten. And she would try to play with me. She had a beach ball. She'd throw it at me, and I'd just stand there and let it bounce off of me. And one time, I went in the front door, out the back door, hid in the brush all day long. And then when the time for my mother to come, I went back through and got in the car. And Miss Howard met my mother downtown one day, and Miss Howard asked how I was doing. And she said, I'd been to school every day, and they caught up with me. Now, you know how that's a miserable feeling to be like that. I was a miserable little boy growing up in those lower grades.
You know, with regard to the service, I know that you're saying it was no big deal, but the government gave you a Bronze Star. You must have done something. You said you weren't scared.
Well, I'd say I wasn't scared, but I didn't give much thought about death at that time.
But looking back now, with the lens of history and knowing that more than 400,000 Americans died, you've been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, you've seen all those gold stars, you know that dozens of guys from your own high school were killed in World War II. Do you look back and realize that maybe it was more dangerous than you even understood at the time, and that maybe somebody was looking out for you?
Yes, I have thought about that somebody was watching over me. You know, I wasn't a Christian back then, but later on, when I was about 29 years old, I put my faith in God, in Jesus Christ, and I know he was watching over me. There was a couple experiences before I went into service where I didn't understand how it was that I wasn't hurt. One time over at my uncle's, and he was planting cotton, I was sitting on the front of the planter looking down into the shoes to make sure the cotton seed was falling. And my cousin Roy was sitting up in the seat, and my uncle was driving the tractor, and I hollered and told him to stop, but I wasn't aware of any problem. But about that time, there was a jack shaft that had a big old nail through it hooked over, and it caught my belt and it squeezed me up. And I had eaten a big bait of red jello, and it all came out and run down over me. my uncle jumped off the tractor, and my God, and then run around and around the tractor and took off. And Roy, my cousin, he was several years older than me. He took his knife out and cut my belt and all, but it didn't hurt me at all. So that was one time I didn't understand how it was that I hollered and he stopped. And because of that, I wasn't injured anymore than I was.
Could have been killed?
Oh, yes, I could have been killed easy. Another time I came in on a tractor. It was a big L.A. Case tractor from the field that has been out working. We had a shed in the back half, and on both ends you could go around the shed into a yard. And on the other end, my father had potato seeds stacked up, and you couldn't get around that way. And when I come in, I went to go around the far end where the seed were. I couldn't go. But if I had turned and went to this side of that shed, there was a big eucalyptus tree, and a big old limb fell down about the time I would have been under that. That gave me some thought.
Well, you think about those things and everything you went through in the Army, and if you didn't make it through all that, your kids and grandkids wouldn't be here, right?
That's right. I have 3 grandkids and 7 great-grandkids, and I've got another one on the road. So I'm just sorry that my wife couldn't be here to enjoy those great-grandkids, because she would have been really happy. But she died in 2004.
Is there anything else that you want to say about the men that you served with in World War II, whether it was from then or from what you've realized with all your interactions with Honor Flight, that you think is really important for the rest of us to understand about that time in our nation's history?
I think it's important that the generation nowadays do understand what we saved the world from, the domination of Germany, Italy, and Japan. I know it'd be a different world altogether, and I'm thankful for those servicemen that give their life, especially. Those are the heroes. And I'm thankful for those that have been able to come back from the service, that we have a chance to get together. The Honor Flight meet once a month for a reunion around a breakfast. That is very important to me and David. I've become acquainted with a lot of veterans that have much more experience than I had, of some being wounded and all. I'm thankful that I have this association with Honor Flight and the veterans that have been able to go.
What was the most meaningful part of the Honor Flight experience for you?
Well, I think the World War II Memorial, a very beautiful memorial. And when you look up at all the stars on there, which represents, I forget, what is it, 1,000 or people to each star that was killed, and see that and understand that how many lives were lost to save the world in. That was a great experience. And also going to the Arlington Cemetery, the unknown soldier's tomb where they have the guards guarding at all time. That was a big experience. And I appreciate our congressman for spending his time for us when we were into the Capitol and taking time to have a picture with each one of us separately. I really appreciated his time he spent with us.
Yeah, because he's the House Majority Leader now, Kevin McCarthy of Bakersfield, and there's a photo of you and your brother with him. Well, before I forget, I want to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling me a little bit about what you've been through. Was there anything I didn't ask you about that you wanted to share?
I think I've said enough.
David, can you vouch for everything Emory said, or did he tell me any lies there?
Well, for a long time, I've never heard some of them stories he's been telling you. In other words, I guess he's kind of kept it into himself all this time. And
you mean just right now, some of the things he said you've never heard?
Yeah, yes it was. Some of them time he fired that mortar. I see he never did talk about that.
From your perspective, when your brother was over there in Europe, were you concerned about him?
Yeah, I worried about him while he's gone. And my mother, now she was definitely real worried about him all that time.
And then you end up in the Army, Camp Roberts out in Paso Robles, California. We're training there, and you heard your brother say he thought for sure you would have been in the invasion of Japan. Was that what you expected?
Yes, I was expecting that. Really, I wasn't expecting what I heard the sergeant say to us. He said, "Some of you boys aren't coming home." That's the first thought I ever had that I might not make it. And, of course, when they said, "We're going to teach you to be killers." Now, I wasn't used to that kind of talk, or especially to all that profanity they use in the Army.
Never heard about that. What are you talking about?
They were combat infantrymen themselves. They'd been over there and knowed about it. So they knew if some of the boys wouldn't be coming back.
And, you know, the government estimate said upwards of 1 million Americans would have been killed in an invasion of mainland Japan, and many more Japanese. So you were at Camp Roberts when the bomb was dropped?
Yes, I was at Camp Roberts. I was in the 8th week of training when they dropped that first atom bomb. And we had officers come over in their jeeps and get out and gather us together and tell us about this big bomb they dropped over there. Of course, we all cheered. We were just tickled to death. And I'm still tickled to death.
Because you're alive, and you might not have been if they hadn't. You answered my question already, the reception that news got there. And then, you know, shortly thereafter, within 10 days, Japan had surrendered.
I know it was all over. I was getting ready to be shipped out, and that's when they changed all our clothing. We started issuing warm clothing. We knew we was going to go somewhere where it's cold.
Yeah, and you'd go where it was real cold. Was that a relief to you, though? I mean, now we know when the war ended, but at the time, none of you knows when and if this war is going to end. So when you find out that the fighting is over and you don't have to be part of it, was that a big relief to you?
Well, of course, it's a big relief to us. All we had to do is go over there and occupy a little island out in the middle of nowhere, because it's an important place. They had an airport right there in the middle of the Aleutian chain. Them Japanese had started up them islands. We even had one body buried there on Adak where I was at. But some of them had quite a few Japanese that had been on them.
So you end up on the island of Adak in the Aleutians. Japan has surrendered. The war is over, but there's still work to do. So what kind of work were you guys doing? This is an Army outfit up there at Adak.
Military police. We was guarding warehouses. I think we had three warehouses, and we had the main gate. We'd change guards about every couple hours.
How was the weather?
Terrible. I never seen so much wind and snow in my life. You know, with the wind blowing, it'd blow that snow in the big old mountain drifts. I think. There's one time when I couldn't even get down to the docks to go on guard duty. And them poor guys down there in them warehouses that were on guard, they couldn't be relieved there for about 2 or 3 days while we was able to go and change guards with it.
Did it ever get so bad weather-wise that you said, you know, I would have rather gone to Japan?
No. No way. No, I was quite happy there in Adak.
What are you proud of with relation to your time in the Army?
I was just proud to be in the Army.
I asked your brother to tell me about you. How would you describe your brother and the things you appreciate about him?
Well, I just appreciate it being my brother. We get along great all the time, and we do everything together. And right now, especially since all our other family's gone, it's just him and me. We got to think of places we want to go see before we pass away.
Well, you talk about your adventures, and I guess that kind of started with you both going on that honor flight, Kern County to Washington, D.C. You know, 16 million Americans served, but a very small fraction of them have seen that memorial. And most of the guys who go, they go there and they think about their brother who didn't live long enough to make it, or their friend who never got to see it. To be able to experience all of that with your brother, what did that mean to you?
I just wish they all could have went. And I keep thinking about all the ones that have died since I've been here. I know of several different ones that passed away. And I'm just can't hardly wait till this WASCO reunion comes up, because I went through high school there. And I'm from the decade of the 40s to 50, the class of 45.
Do you ever tease your brother about the fact that he's older than you, but you graduated from high school 2 years before he did?
No, I don't want to say anything about that to him.
I think we need an explanation for that. If you're almost 2 years older, how come he's class of 45 and you're class of 47?
Well, I'll have to say it was because of the war. I went into the service before I graduated from high school. So he got to graduate before I did. I come back from the war, went back to high school, and then graduated. I graduated in 47.
Did you play any sports there for the Tigers?
They wouldn't let me. I said I was too old.
I was going to say, you know, that would have been, it's every high schooler's dream to come back a couple years later when you're older and bigger and stronger, but they saw you coming, huh? Wouldn't let you?
They wouldn't let me play in competitive sports. PE classes I played with. I done pretty well then, went into PE classes.
Well, you didn't ask me about my football playing when I was in high school.
Well, let's hear about your football career.
You know, usually Shafter and Wasco, they just really have a big time when them two get together. And, of course, that particular time when I was playing, we beat Shafter 33-0. Of course, later, well, they beat us, shut us out, too. But it's just a big thing. We enjoyed talking about it.
When you get to this centennial reunion, that's what you're going to be talking about, the time you shut out Shafter 33-0.
Probably so.
I know I asked Emory, but I don't know if I asked you. For you, with regard to Honor Flight, what was the most satisfying part of it for you?
That Arlington, when you see all the graves of where the soldier had been buried there that passed away. Now, all them are really the heroes now, the ones that didn't ever make it back.
That is a perfect way to wrap things up today. It's something we should never forget. More than 406,000 Americans died while serving in World War II, including 32 from Wasco, California. We're out of time. Thanks for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.